Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome once again to Book Reviews right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer host, Walter McConnell, coming up in the first half of today's program. It's American history and politics as we take a look at George William Van Cleve's new book, We Have Not a Government, about the drafting of our country's first Articles of Confederation. We then turn our attention to a momentous occasion in World War II, the Dunkirk evacuation. Author Michael Korda takes a look at it historically and also personally, detailing how it affected his family and himself as a six-year-old boy. And we'll wrap up the first half of the show with a look at the new novel by author Philip Pullman, whose best-selling His Dark Materials trilogy included the beloved character Lyra Belacqua. Lyra is back in a prequel entitled La Belle Sauvage. Those reviews and more when we return in just a moment. And we are back. Thank you for joining us here on Book Reviews today. We're going to start off this week's show by turning, as we have often done, to the Washington Post for our first review. From their website at washingtonpost.com and the Book World section comes this review. The headline reads, "In terms of political stalemate and crisis, is today very different from the 1780s? It is a review of We Have Not a Government, the Articles of Confederation and the Road to the Constitution, written by George William Van Cleve and reviewed for the Washington Post by Jack Rakove. Back in 1889, as the centennial of the Constitution was closing, the historian John Fiske published The Critical Period of American History, 1783 to 1789. His title phrase has beguiled and haunted historians ever since. Were the years between the close of the Revolutionary War and the adoption of the Constitution really so bad? If this was so critical a period, what were its defining problems and challenges? Perhaps this image of crisis was simply a ploy the framers of the Constitution concocted to justify their efforts to reverse the swirl of democratic forces throughout the states. Or perhaps, as Gordon Wood argued in his epochal book, The Creation of the American Republic, 1776 to 1787, this mood of crisis reflected a diffuse disappointment over the factional turmoil of the mid-1780s. Somehow, the Republican promise of 1776, with its great emphasis on the civic virtue of the people, had evaporated. George William Van Cleve decidedly favors the crisis model. His new book, We Have Not a Government, provides a focused explanation of the reasons the Articles of Confederation, the nation's first federal constitution, went lurching toward collapse. Like most historians, Van Cleve wants to study the past for its own sake, rather than drawing lessons for the present. Yet while writing this book, he was surprised to discover how often acquaintances linked his academic concerns with our own political travails. We, too, have had many reasons to declare that we have not a government, even before the least qualified presidential candidate in American history entered the White House. Van Cleve's title phrase sounds all the more apt today when Republicans control the government but are badly strapped to legislate, when the executive branch lacks hundreds of appointments, and when the sole holder of the executive power of the United States is badly ignorant of public policy as well as the principles and substance of the Constitution that he swore to preserve, protect, and defend before the unprecedented crowds that he claimed packed the mall on Inauguration Day. Still, a working historian would tell lay readers that the real task of history is less to draw straight lines from past to present than to appreciate the differences between then and now. So let us go back to the great story of the founding era, tracing the road to Philadelphia that led to the bold political strokes of 1787 and 88. "We have not a government" is very much a work of synthesis, but in the best sense of the term. Van Cleve patiently examines the specific matters of public policy that vexed national politics in the mid-1780s. He draws sharp conclusions and generally takes decided stands on matters that historians still actively dispute. After 8 years of war, American society did not enjoy an easy path to recovery. Massive public and private debts saddled the economy. Congress repeatedly tottered on the verge of bankruptcy. Its system of levying requisitions on the states failed to produce the revenue it needed. Lacking resources, Congress could not project national authority into the trans-Appalachian interior, where British and Spanish influence and the justified fears of Native Americans threatened the orderly settlement of the Ohio Valley. British goods flooded American markets while American ships were denied access to British ports. The Spanish closure of the Mississippi River to American navigation in 1784 weakened the political loyalty of the thousands of settlers heading west. It also sharpened sectional tensions between northern and southern states. These were badly exacerbated in 1786 when Secretary of Foreign Affairs John Jay tried to conclude a commercial treaty with Spain that would subordinate the South's concerns with the Mississippi to the commercial interests of northern merchants. These collective failures demonstrated the imbecility of the Continental Congress and the Articles of Confederation. Congress began submitting amendments to the states as soon as the Confederation took formal effect in March 1781. But none of these amendments ever attained the unanimous approval of all 13 state legislatures. Minuscule Rhode Island, that rocky outcrop of New England, adopted anti-federal policies that seemed to doom any chance of constitutional amendment. These are familiar events, and Van Cleve does not break new ground in surveying them. To be blunt about it, his rather wooden prose does not quite convey the excitement of American politics that has engaged other commentators. Yet he is absolutely clear on one key point. Both within the individual states and at the level of national government, the obstacles to constitutional reform were high. Regional suspicions ran deep, and the idea that the Union could devolve into two or three confederations was a real probability. The uprising of debtor farmers in western Massachusetts in Shays' Rebellion was not, as Van Cleve further notes, a crucial turning point in developing new ideas of national government, but it did persuade major leaders in Massachusetts and Connecticut to support the reform ideas that James Madison and Alexander Hamilton were developing, especially after they met at the Annapolis Convention in September 1786. If there is one critical character in Van Cleve's story, it is George Washington. Artfully quoted throughout the book, he emerges as the most nationalist leader of all, the one most committed to creating an imperial republic. At first glance, for lay readers, this discovery may not seem surprising, but among scholars, Washington is often taken for granted. A major force, perhaps, but a less creative political entrepreneur than Madison and Hamilton, the two actors he relied on most. Van Cleve departs from other historians in not giving their distinctive contributions to the transformation of American constitutionalism the attention they deserve. What Van Cleve does demonstrate persuasively is that the genuine crisis of the Confederation required creating a staggeringly powerful national government through a, quote, grand bargain that went well beyond what any state might have asked for itself. Some commentators still see the Constitution as the self-interested work of an elite propertied class, recycling the tired arguments Charles Beard made a century ago. Not Van Cleve, He argues, rightly, in my view, that the framers of the Constitution took very large political risks, not out of selfish class interest, and not just from perceived necessity, but from objective necessity. It was this perception of manifest crisis that broke the multiple stalemates that had vexed the Confederation since 1783. That perception of dogged impasse is what has jogged Van Cleve's acquaintances to muse that the 1780s and the 2010s may not be as different as one might assume. Of course, by any objective criteria, the differences between these two decades, separated by a near quarter millennium, overwhelm their superficial similarities. The source of stalemate in American politics today inheres within the Republican Party. Beyond reciting its ideological shibboleths, which work best when one is in opposition, this is a party that can barely agree with itself on a course of action, much less imagine how to collaborate with the Democrats. Given the procedural shackles of the Hastert Rule, which requires legislation in the House to command the support of a majority of the GOP majority, the feckless leadership of Senator Mitch McConnell and President Trump's gross ignorance of public policy, the Republican Party is an empty vessel of political action. There may be no obvious political lessons from the 1780s, but if Van Cleve is right, there are some obvious political morals. And that was a review of We Have Not a Government, The Articles of Confederation and the Road to the Constitution, written by George William Van Cleve, published by Chicago Press, 390 pages long. It retails for $30. Once again, We Have Not a Government was reviewed for the Washington Post Book World section by Jack Rakove, who teaches history and political science at Stanford University. We stay with the Washington Post as we continue the first half of today's program. Again, from their website at washingtonpost.com in the Book World section comes an article whose headline reads, Dunkirk, the Reality and Myth, and Its Place in a Little Boy's Memory. It is a review of Alone, Britain, Churchill, and Dunkirk, Defeat into Victory, written by Michael Korda and reviewed for the Washington Post by Marianne Zagady-Masak. Like Waterloo and Stalingrad, Gettysburg and the Somme, Dunkirk is a place that has become shorthand for a blood-drenched turning point in a greater war. Each name is resonant with misbegotten strategy, unforgiving terrain, and the loss of life in truly epic proportions, even when measured by an already costly war. But Dunkirk has a particular distinction, one that Michael Korda captures in his subtitle to the fascinating and occasionally exasperating book, Alone, Britain, Churchill, and Dunkirk, Defeat into Victory. Now, for whatever reasons, it's Dunkirk's turn for cinematic and popular attention. The story, even by World War II standards, is dramatic. Hundreds of thousands of British Expeditionary Force and French troops, having been defeated by the Germans as they tried to defend Belgium, the Netherlands, and France, were stranded on a French beach from May 26th until June 4th, 1940. Christopher Nolan's eponymous film offers only the most glancing reference to how they ended up in such a fix, and focuses instead on the sheer vulnerability, terror, and discipline of the 400,000 BEF soldiers when they faced, seemingly out of nowhere, the Luftwaffe, which left them cowering and praying to be spared a fatal bullet until the next assault. Or until the lucky ones were evacuated, provided, of course, they weren't aboard a vessel that hit a mine or another German attack. For Nolan, despite the carnage, the myth of the British victory involves the humble, plucky armada of private sailors and captains of all ages who commandeered fishing boats, sailboats, tugboats, ferries, and nearly anything that could float to bring the boys back home. By the time they were through, 198,000 British BEF soldiers, half the force sent over, and about 140,000 French soldiers were evacuated. Korda offers a broader context to this great story by pointing out that while this fleet captured the minds of most people with yachtsmen and sea scouts performing miracles, the reality was that good planning by the Royal Navy was responsible for taking the lion's share of those who were evacuated. With riveting detail and often pitch-perfect pacing of the dramatic tension of the early part of the war, Korda interweaves history, politics, geopolitical intrigue, backroom bargaining, generals, admirals, prime ministers, and a Führer, military strategy, and autobiography to tell the story surrounding those 9 days. He begins with the rumblings of war over Danzig and the Polish corridor in August 1939, and more than 400 pages later, ends with the battered, often traumatized, and fortunate last soldiers arriving in Britain. Korda was also a witness, albeit a pint-sized one, from a formidable family. "How we arrived there, on the brink of disaster, is the subject of this book," he writes. "At once the modest account of my family's dispersal and a history of the greater events that led to Dunkirk, and to Britain's finest hour," as Winston Churchill called it. His use of the first-person plural is revealing. Korda's massive literary output over 45 years includes biographies of Robert E. Lee, T.E. Lawrence, and Ulysses S. Grant. With Wings Like Eagles explores the untold history of the Battle of Britain, and his 1979 memoir, Charmed Lives, A Family Romance, is the remarkable story of how three audacious and talented Hungarian Jewish refugee brothers arrived in Britain in the 1930s and reached the stratosphere in the American and British film industries. One of those brothers was Korda's father, Vincent, the art director of the films, and his uncles were Alexander, a storied producer, and Zoltan, a writer and director. Throughout Alone, these famous relatives and spouses, including Auntie Merle Oberon, Alexander's movie star wife, make cameo appearances, offering a kind of cinematic interplay between seismic historical events and inside stories of movie-making during wartime, squabbling relatives, and a little boy watching it all with his nanny. Over the years, the spirit of Dunkirk has largely erased the reality of it, Korda observes. The paradox was how a catastrophic military defeat was transformed into a mythic victory in almost the amount of time it took to cross the channel from Dunkirk to Dover. Korda remembers listening to the family's portable radio when British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain announced, "This country is at war with Germany." Several months after that announcement, Chamberlain lost the confidence of his parliament, and in May 1940, Churchill became prime minister, just as the news came that Germany had attacked Holland, Belgium, and France. The disorganized efforts of the British and French attempting to defend Western Europe were overwhelmed by the Germans, which led to the humiliation and glory of Dunkirk. There are times when Korda's recreation is superb and panoramic. The movements of troops, the despair of politicians, the memories of soldiers, the engagement of the British public feel almost novelistic in pacing and dramatic tension. Photographs, maps, and even cartoons offer still more opportunities for a fully immersive experience. What is less satisfying is the parallel story of his family, whose occasionally unexpected appearances have the quality of a Dickensian non sequitur. In the midst of a riveting chapter on inept communications on the ground within the BEF and how dire military circumstances were presented to the British public, the scene suddenly shifts to the Korda nursery, where the fate of the BEF was added to my nightly prayers, a sign that by then even Nanny Lowe, despite the best efforts of the Ministry of Information, understood that the BEF was in grave danger. One longs for Korda to provide the same psychological insight, emotional resonance, or glimmer of introspection to his own circumstances, as he so deftly does with Churchill, Chamberlain, BEF Commander Lord Gort, and others. In the end, however, these shortcomings might be yet another example of the British pluck and discipline that are so much a part of Dunkirk's role, not just in history, but in the country's psychology. When Korda says he seeks to explain how we arrived there, he may not be writing only about how Dunkirk embodied and foretold Britain's solitary status in the world, but also how alone one six-year-old boy felt when the world was at war. And that was a review of Alone, Britain, Churchill, and Dunkirk, Defeat into Victory, written by Michael Korda, published by Norton, 525 pages long. It was reviewed for The Washington Post by Marianne Segedi Masak, a senior editor in the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones and the author of I Kiss Your Hands Many Times, Hearts, Souls, and Wars in Hungary. Listening to book reviews right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. We turn to the New York Times as we continue the first half of today's program. From their website at nytimes.com in the Sunday Book Review section comes this article. The headline reads, With La Belle Sauvage, Philip Pullman begins a new trilogy. It is a review of The Book of Dust, Volume 1, La Belle Sauvage, written by Philip Pullman and reviewed here for the New York Times by Sarah Lyle. It's been nearly two decades since Philip Pullman published The Golden Compass and the other two books in the His Dark Materials trilogy, but I still remember how intoxicating they were to read and how bereft I felt afterward. As with a long-ago love affair, they were perfect, in part because they ended even as the reader longed for more. Now, suddenly, more has arrived, and that requires an adjustment in thinking. La Belle Sauvage is the first volume of a new Pullman trilogy that starts before His Dark Materials begins and will continue, the author says, nearly a decade after it finishes. This is exciting news to the world of Pullman's obsessives, who, if we are honest, want nothing more than to find out what happened before and what happens next. Pullman has produced little teasing addendums before, but this is the first serious addition to the work. But the new novel brings an attendant anxiety. Can it be as good as the previous ones? And if reading those books felt something like taking the best sort of hallucinogenic drug, then can the new one deliver the same transportive rush? Is such a thing even possible? Written nominally for young adults, but just as suited to older ones, His Dark Materials sold nearly 18 million copies, was translated into 40 languages, won numerous awards, and was adapted for both stage and screen. It is as imaginative, complex, and unexpected as anything in the Harry Potter series, though the comparison is not really fair. Pullman's writing is more graceful and sophisticated, and his ambitions are of a greater magnitude than J.K. Rowling's. His Dark Materials is at heart a daringly subversive retelling of Milton's Paradise Lost, posited on the notion that the world is saved not ruined, by original sin. Using the trappings of fantasy, multiple worlds, extraordinary creatures, extravagant adventures, quantum physics, it explores profound questions of good and evil, the nature of consciousness, the tension between religion and science, and what lies after death. The new trilogy is named The Book of Dust, after a mysterious elementary particle introduced in His Dark Materials that has something to do with consciousness and is the subject of great scientific and religious debate and anxiety. As the story opens, we find ourselves back in the curious Oxford of the Golden Compass, one that is real, but not real. An off-kilter iteration set in some sort of Einsteinian alternate universe. In this world, everyone has a daemon, an animal manifestation of his or her soul that changes form frequently in childhood, but settles into a particular animal at adolescence. In this world, people read Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, but they also take photograms, travel by Zeppelin, and use anbaric energy to operate their machinery. There's an academic field known as experimental theology. When the novel begins, a terrible flood is impending, and the formidable church, based in Geneva, is consolidating the power it will wield so frighteningly in the later books. Malcolm, an 11-year-old boy whose parents own an inn and whose prized possession is a canoe called La Belle Sauvage that gives the book its title, stumbles into the service of an underground group working to subvert the magisterium, the church's ruling body. He has a proprietary concern for a 6-month-old baby in the care of the nuns at a nearby priory. This is Lyra, who, though of course he does not know it, will go on to become the heroine of His Dark Materials. She's in terrible danger. The magisterium wants her, and so does a disgraced and possibly deranged physicist with a hideously deformed hyena daemon. Pullman has said all along that he does not want to impose his views on the reader, but here, as in the earlier trilogy, he deliberately makes religion and its adherents, intolerant, power-hungry, cruel, pervasive, authoritarian, his standout villains. The exceptions are the nuns Malcolm befriends, who are good people. Deploying methods that evoke the Nazis or the KGB, the magisterium demands obsequious ideological submission from an increasingly fearful population. The book reacquaints us with some familiar figures, including Lyra's morally complicated parents, whose relationship becomes a bit spicier when you learn what happened to the man her mother used to be married to. And it introduces new ones like Dr. Hannah Relf, a scholar whose specialty is studying the alethiometer, an instrument of enigmatic power whose 36 images carry multiple layers of meaning. We also learn more about the strange phenomena of dust and the battle to unlock its secrets and control it. As a treat, there are scenes demonstrating the special bond between humans and their daemons, one of Pullman's most delightful creations, as when Lyra babbles endlessly with her baby daemon, the two teaching each other how to talk. La Belle Sauvage sometimes lags. And curiously, for such a gifted storyteller, Pullman includes long stretches of flat dialogue in which Malcolm essentially repeats information he has already heard to new people who have not yet heard it. There's a bit more detail than is necessary about how hard it is to change and feed a baby while escaping a flood in a boat. I recognize that my expectations are impossibly high, and that in literature, as well as in romance, you cannot return to the exact feeling you had before. I'd like to think that Pullman is biding his time, laying down the groundwork for what is yet to come. And even with its longueurs, the book is full of wonder. By the end, when Malcolm and a young woman named Alice embark with Lyra on a perilous water odyssey, replete with strange undersea creatures and various other things not dreamed of in our philosophy, it becomes truly thrilling. Wait till you hear about the ancient practice of scholastic sanctuary at Jordan, a fictional Oxford college. It's a stunning achievement, the universe Pullman has created and continues to build on. All that remains is to sit tight and wait for the next installment. And that was a review of La Belle Sauvage, written by Philip Pullman, 464 pages long, published by Knopf. It retails for $22.99. La Belle Sauvage was reviewed for the New York Times Book Review by Sarah Lyall. Well, we have found ourselves just about at the halfway point of today's program. We'll take a break right now for our musical interlude. I'd like to remind you that you were listening to Book Reviews right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Coming up in the second half of today's program, the true story of how 12,000 people died of polluted air in London in 1952, and three new books from university presses that discuss what religion is. Right now, here is today's musical interlude. It's the Jet Set 6 with some retro swing music, in particular, a song called Livin' It Up. Jet Set 6 with today's musical interlude, Livin' It Up. We turn our attention to NPR as we begin the second portion of today's program. From their website at npr.org and the books section comes this review. The headline reads, Death in the Air revisits 5 days when London was choked by poisonous smog. It is a review of Death in the Air, the true story of a serial killer, the Great London Smog, and the strangling of a city. Written by Kate Winkler Dawson and reviewed for the NPR.org website by Maureen Corrigan. Nicknames like a real pea super or a London particular make the quintessential foggy day in London town sound so quaint, an impression that's been intensified in art and literature. Certainly the London of Sherlock Holmes would be a lot less mysterious without that obscuring fog. Impressionist painter Claude Monet, who famously depicted the Houses of Parliament shrouded in mist, said that, "Without the fog, London would not be a beautiful city. It is the fog that gives it its magnificent breadth." Monet was talking about an added dimension to the city, but breath, as in human breath, was precisely what the fog stole from London in the terrible winter of 1952. For 5 days in December of that year, London was blanketed by a yellow, toxic vapor that smothered its inhabitants. By the time this poisonous air mass moved on and death records were correctly tallied, some 12,000 people would be recognized as fatalities of what was called the Great Smog of 1952. Journalist Kate Winkler Dawson has written an intriguing book about this silent disaster, which was born out of a perfect storm of freak weather patterns and environmental ignorance. The moist air of the Gulf Stream stalled for days over London that winter, long enough for there to be a deadly buildup of soot, sulfur dioxide, and other poisons emitted from the cheap sea coal, known as nutty slack, that most Londoners used to heat their flats and houses. The Great Smog also gave off a great stink, acrid and burning. In fact, on the cover of Dawson's book, there is an arresting black-and-white photograph of a young woman wearing a pearl choker and a tweedy-looking suit, with her chiffon scarf wrapped around her mouth like a face mask. The photograph is no doubt meant to be suggestive of Dawson's other disturbing subject here. Death in the Air attempts to be a kind of a true crime book about two stranglers on the loose in London that winter. One, an environmental killer, the smog, the other, the infamous serial killer John Reginald Christie, who lured women to his Notting Hill flat and murdered them by suffocation. He's responsible for at least 8 deaths. Those parallel plot lines never quite intersect. Death in the Air would have been an even more compelling book without Dawson's somewhat forced attempt to make connections between these two London stranglers. Another strike against the Christie story is that his grisly career has been exhaustively documented in books and films. The Great Smog, however, was underreported when it happened, and is still not all that widely known. It seems an even more timely tale in our own age of extreme weather and environmental catastrophes. Dawson cuts a precise narrative path through the smog by marshalling together an array of government and newspaper reports and interviews with people who lived through those terrible 5 days when trains, buses, and ships on the Thames came to a standstill and crime was rampant. Most affecting are the first-person recollections of a woman who was 13 years old that winter. Rosemary Sargent's working-class neighborhood had been bombed during the Blitz, and she and her siblings had been separated from their beloved father for years during the war. When the Great Smog began, Rosemary's father, his lungs already weakened by war work, started gasping for air. She and her mother stumbled to the doctor's office to get a nitroglycerin tablet. By the time they returned, Rosemary's father had died. He had to be laid out in the parlor of their small house for 2 weeks, as Dawson writes. One of the most astonishing things about this deadly fog was who at first alarmed, not politicians, reporters, or even doctors, but undertakers. Across London, funeral directors reported a surge in bodies, so many that the demand for caskets was insatiable. When the fog finally lifted, it took months, even years, for officials to realize that thousands of deaths attributed to heart disease or the flu were really caused by the toxic air. In 1956, Britain passed the milestone Clean Air Act, which tightened restrictions on industrial smoke and banned coal in many houses and industries. Dawson says it was the first comprehensive legislation to attack air pollution. The number of fog events and deaths immediately dropped. The lessons for the present, Dawson suggests, are as clear as the air in front of our eyes. And that was a review of Death in the Air, written by Kate Winkler Dawson, published by Hachette, 341 pages long. It retails for $27. Once again, Death in the Air was reviewed for the NPR.org website by their regular book reviewer, Maureen Corrigan. Well, as we begin to turn the corner into the final third of today's program, we return to the New York Times for our next review, or multiple reviews. It is the Ivory Tower column of the New York Times Book Review, which collects reviews of books published by university presses. The headline this week reads, Unknown Unknowns, Three Inquiries into Religion, all books reviewed by James Ryerson. The philosopher Tim Crane is an atheist. Though educated in a Catholic environment, he has come to believe that nothing exists beyond the world of everyday experience and scientific explanation, nothing transcendent. Some people look around and think, this can't be all there is. Crane is not one of those people. That he avows atheism as opposed to agnosticism does not strike him as presumptuous or arrogant. He has considered the relevant evidence and arguments as best he can and drawn the most reasonable-seeming conclusion. What more is a thinker supposed to do? He is convinced religious believers are wrong. But his qualm is not with them. As he explains in his lucid and thoughtful book, The Meaning of Belief, Religion from an Atheist's Point of View, he is more troubled by some of his fellow atheists, specifically those who campaign against religion as an irrational vestige of primitive thought, outmoded by modern science. A notable feature of this campaign, Crane observes, has been its general failure to change the minds of religious people. Maybe those people are just foolish, or maybe, as Crane is inclined to think, they do not recognize themselves or their beliefs in the picture of religion under attack. The atheists may miss their target because they are aiming elsewhere, and because they fail to understand what religion is, they lack a suitably realistic and feasible way to relate to people of faith, which is to say most people. In a spirit of reconciliation, Crane proposes to paint a more accurate picture of religion for his fellow unbelievers. Religion is an immense, sprawling, and variegated affair. Any attempt to define it, however comprehensive, will omit some aspects. And most attempts to define it, however crude, will capture something. The name of the game is what you see as central. Crane resists the notion, common to combative atheists, that the core of religion is an archaic cosmology, beliefs about things like the origin of the universe and supernatural agents, grafted onto a moral code. If you conceive of religion this way, as bad science plus arbitrary injunctions, of course you think it should be replaced by good science and rational ethics. For Crane, the religious worldview is better understood as the combination of two attitudes. First, a sense of the transcendent, of an unseen moral order to the universe, often known as God. Second, an identification with a community that tries to make sense of the world by attempting to bring its members into alignment with this moral order through a tradition of narratives and rituals. Crane concedes there is a cosmology here. A belief in the transcendent is a claim about the universe. He also grants that religion, like science, is trying to explain things. But the kind of explanation and the kind of cosmology offered by religion, which does not expect all aspects of the world to be intelligible, are nothing like those of science, which strives to eliminate mystery. The atheist and evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins has suggested that the idea of God is a hypothesis about a supernatural agent, ventured as a possible account of perplexing natural phenomena. Crane disagrees. The God of actual religious people, the source of the unseen order that imbues everything with significance, is both vaguer and more nuanced than that. Science takes complex or confusing things and tries to explain them in terms of simpler or clearer things. God is not simple or clear. Religion isn't supposed to be a neat explanation of causal forces. It's supposed to be a difficult explanation of the meaning of life. This explanation, Crane contends, is destined to be forever incomplete, always a struggle to fathom, not because it is missing some key facts, but because it involves attempts to encounter the transcendent. Crane himself thinks there is no transcendent reality, but he knows there can be no proof of this. Given the ineluctable enigma of existence, he believes religion can be a rational, intelligent human reaction to the mystery of the world. This picture of religion would no doubt strike the sociologist Christian Smith as too cognitive, cerebral, intellectualist. In his substantial, richly informed book, Religion: What It Is, How It Works, and Why It Matters, Smith offers a social scientific theory that disputes the notion advanced by titans of social thought like Clifford Geertz and Max Weber, that religion is a cultural meaning system. Religion is not at heart a set of replies to existential questions, Smith writes, even if it often involves this. For Smith, the paradigmatic expression of religion is something like praying to God to cure your wife's cancer, or beseeching a cloud spirit to bring rain to your withering crops. Having surveyed religious traditions across the world and throughout history, he sees religion at its core as a set of culturally prescribed practices that aim to help people access superhuman powers in the hope of realizing human goods and avoiding bad things, typically in conditions and situations they cannot control and with problems they cannot solve. Smith is quick to acknowledge that this is not all religion provides, nor the sole reason people practice religion. But he maintains it is the central reason, and unlike other things religion does, like providing an identity, which a profession can also do, or seeking existential meaning, which philosophy can also do, it is unique to religion. A methodological hazard of discussing religion at this level of abstraction is the need, as Crane says, to generalize the views of billions of people. Smith hopes to avoid this difficulty by focusing less on subjective religious belief and more on public religious practices, which are more or less objective. This has allowed him, he believes, to focus on what religion is. He distinguishes this from what religion can do, its secondary outgrowths, things like fostering identity, meaning, community, and so on. Though these derivative features are often crucial for the personal experience and institutional strength of religion, they do not constitute its ultimate raison d'être. Smith's is a theoretical work, but he provides ample illustrations of his theory, including religious traditions that might at first seem like counterexamples, such as American Protestant evangelicism, which stresses the importance of beliefs and attitudes over rituals and customs. In all cases, he finds formalized calls for heavenly assistance, often involving this-worldly concerns like financial security and family health to be central. Worries about things like the meaning of life and the problem of evil are peripheral. If religion could not promise the help of superhuman powers, he concludes, then religion would not exist. At some point in the distant past, of course, religion did not exist. The story of its emergence in the universe and the significance of this story for our understanding of the nature of religion are the subject of The New Cosmic Story, Inside Our Awakening Universe, by theologian John F. Hout. Like Crane and Smith, he takes a generalized approach to religion, focusing on what all such traditions have in common. Unlike Crane and Smith, he sees religion as something whose journey, like that of the rest of the universe described by modern science, is unfinished, and hence whose nature must be understood in part in terms of where it may be headed. Hout describes religion as the anticipation of a rightness that is now mostly out of range. This formulation resembles Crane's with its transcendent moral order, both everywhere present and agonizingly beyond reach. But Hout, a man of faith, disagrees with Crane that religion's truths will necessarily remain so remote. Ever since the Big Bang, we have seen the emergence of matter, then life, then conscious life, and then, most notably, in Hout's estimation, the human consciousness of interior striving that finds its zenith in our spiritual adventures. Who knows what advances in religion the next stage of the universe's evolution will bring? Thanks to modern science, Hout argues, we know the cosmic story is far from over, and can look patiently and expectantly ahead for a possible meaning to it all. Should such a cosmic gift come to pass, it would amount to a salvation of the physical world, not a deliverance from it, a kind of redemption perhaps even an atheist could live with. And again, that was the Ivory Tower column of the New York Times Book Review. All books were reviewed for the New York Times by James Ryerson. To briefly recap them, we started out with a review of The Meaning of Belief, Religion from an Atheist's Point of View, written by Tim Crane and published by the Harvard University Press. It retails for $24.95. Following that, we reviewed Religion: What It Is, How It Works, and Why It Matters, written by Christian Smith, published by Princeton University. It retails for $35. And last but not least, we reviewed The New Cosmic Story, Inside Our Awakening Universe, written by John F. Hout, published by Yale University. It retails for $25. With only a few minutes left in today's program, we turn to the Los Angeles Times and their sci-fi column for some capsule reviews. The headline reads, Science Fiction Gets Criminal. All books reviewed for the LA Times by Swapna Krishna. Science fiction is often treated like a genre, and for good reason, but genre lines can be incredibly blurry, with quite a bit of variation and room to play. One area that's been growing recently is the subgenre of crime stories and mysteries within sci-fi. Here is a selection worth investigating. The Salt Line by Holly Goddard Jones. This is an exciting novel with unexpected twists and turns and excellent character development, but it starts small, with a tick. Far into the future, when climate change has taken its toll on our planet, a tick roams the U.S. and carries with it a deadly, incurable disease. People live clustered in cities, protected from the outside world, but the romance of the wilderness still exists, and tour groups take wealthy adventurers beyond city borders. Marta doesn't want to embark on one of these trips, but her criminal husband, David, insists. As Marta gets to know her fellow travelers, she starts to think that maybe this wasn't such a terrible idea. That is, until her group is attacked from within and someone is murdered. Are Marta's husband's deeds catching up with her, or does someone else in the group have a secret? Not all the characters in this novel are easy to like, but I absolutely believed they were quite capable of anything. Six Wakes by Murr Lafferty. Locked room mysteries go back to the earliest crime fiction. Edgar Allan Poe's The Murders in the Rue Morgue was published in 1841, and this is an excellent addition to the subgenre. In the future, when cloning is legal, people have additional bodies at the ready. Their memories can be downloaded to their new hosts in a snap. But when six clones awaken to a violent scene aboard a spaceship, they find a bloodbath. The victims? Their former selves. It's clear that one of them did the ugly deed, but without memories of the event, it's impossible to tell who. Lafferty builds a rich and vibrant world, all within the confines of a single spaceship. Her characters are incredibly well drawn and vivid. As she explores each clone's past, even the most difficult of them becomes sympathetic. It is a gripping murder mystery that also poses the most difficult philosophical question. What does it mean to be human? Yesterday by Felicia Yap. Felicia Yap's debut novel is set on an Earth much like ours, with one significant twist. People have extremely short memories. Monos, the bulk of society, only remember the events of the past day. Duos, considered the elite of this world, have 2 days of memories. Both monos and duos rely on journals to recall the events of their lives. It's the way the world has always been. It's in this complicated setting that a murder occurs. The body of a young woman with ties to a duo politician, Mark, is found and causes Claire, his long-suffering mono wife, to question everything she thought she knew. It's a poignant look at the fallibility of memory and how we can deceive ourselves into believing the most bald-faced lies to protect our own comfort and security. And again, that was the sci-fi column of the Los Angeles Times Book Review. All books were reviewed for the LA Times by Swapna Krishna. Very briefly, we reviewed The Salt Line by Holly Goddard Jones, published by G.P. Putnam's Son. It retails for $26. Six Wakes by Murr Lafferty, published by Orbit. It retails for $16 in paperback. And Yesterday by Felicia Yap, published by Mulholland Books. It retails for $27. Well, that's it for book reviews this week. I would like to remind you that you have listened to 2 book reviews right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds is a member-supported service. I'm your volunteer host, Walter McConnell. I'll be back next week with more book reviews and more music. Until then, bye-bye.